The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Hello and welcome everyone to the latest episode of the Culturico podcast. My name is Omena Aziz. I am editor-in-chief at Culturico. I'm also an engineer by education and a feminist by passion, and I will be your host today. With me, I have Federico Germani. He is the founder and director of Culturico, essentially my boss, and he is a bioethicist at the University of Zurich. Federico, you obtained your PhD at the University of Zurich, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So I obtained my PhD last year, and now 2 years ago, actually, at the University of Zurich in molecular life sciences. And then I moved on to bioethics. So I needed another challenge.
That sounds amazing. Bioethics, it sounds very relevant, especially given the conditions that we're living in today. And on that note, today we are going to talk about vaccines and the rise of the anti-vaxxer movement. I have a feeling that the phenomenon was growing quite steadily, with scientists and doctors getting more and more worried about it. But let's say lay people or ordinary people like myself only really started getting very worried when the COVID-19 pandemic hit us. So Federico, you've written a paper on this topic and the role social media plays here. Let's talk a little bit about this. How did this topic catch your eye and your interest?
Yeah, so first of all, I think, as you said already, this is a very timely topic. So it is particularly important during a pandemic, especially because, of course, this COVID-19 pandemic can be solved through vaccinations. And it was already a problem before, of course, but the anti-vaccination movement right now has been gaining a momentum. And it is important to understand why this is the case. So I, first of all, tried to look into the root causes of vaccine hesitancy, and social media, of course, play an important role. So based on that, I decided to undertake some research in this area and try to understand indeed the causes of the growth of the anti-vaccination movement, and also to design strategies to prevent scientific misinformation to circulate online, so that we can basically ultimately increase the vaccination rates and halt this problem.
That makes sense. I do have a very interesting question regarding this. We talk a lot about the role social media plays, and obviously developing countries are now also on social media at much higher rates than ever before in the past. But is this maybe just a bias that I have? I feel like maybe this reduction in vaccination seems to me more of a developed world problem, less than a developing world problem. Is there any truth to this, or is this just a bias I'm holding?
No, actually, you're perfectly right. I cannot say for sure this is the case because I haven't conducted, I didn't quantify data on this, but I'm pretty sure this is the case. So the problem is more, of the West, this for sure. This may be due to several reasons, but probably, vaccines are no longer a breakthrough in science for people living in the West, whereas for the developing world, this is still something that is perceived as very important. As a matter of fact, I noticed that on Twitter, the pro-vaccination supporters are mostly from various developing countries. And actually, there is a very large community of vaccination supporters in Pakistan. So that's something that may interest you personally.
That actually does.
Yeah. So it looks very promising in developing countries, but this is important also in that case, because in the future, this may change. if the trends we see in the West are going to be confirmed in developing countries, this is going to be a problem just a bit delayed in time, maybe of a couple of decades. But it's something that needs to be investigated right now to anticipate the problem. So I think it's a global issue and particularly relevant right now in the West.
That's a very good point. If we manage to come up with solutions and ways to deal with this and preempt this in developing countries as a future problem, yeah, we could maybe be looking out for ourselves. So you mentioned Twitter just now, that you looked at Twitter and you saw this community of pro-vaccination and I guess anti-vaxxers. So why were you focusing on Twitter in particular? Because Facebook is also very big, and Facebook has all of these, let's say, groups and communities that are actually a lot more problematic in some ways. But sure. I don't have any data on this, so I would like to hear about how you decided on Twitter instead of Facebook.
No, it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. So as you said already, Facebook has a content that can be shared easily between people. So it makes it a perfect platform for anti-vaccination message to spread around. However, also Twitter is the same from that point of view. So it's very easy to retweet and share contents. And so this is something that Facebook and Twitter share. The advantage of Twitter over Facebook is that the access of content is basically public in most instances. So for example, if I want to look at the history of tweets produced by a particular individual, most likely they will be available publicly. There are only a few profiles that keep their tweets and contents that they share private. So this is not the case on Facebook, for example. And there is another point that actually the anti-vaccination community tends together mostly on Twitter. There is also a large anti-vaccination community on Facebook, like you say, but it seems to be more prevalent on Twitter. And also there is another point that actually it's way easier to do research on Twitter data than Facebook data. So it's very easy to, you know, dig out information from Twitter, also because indeed everything is publicly accessible. So I think all in all, Twitter was just an easier choice for us, but we think it is a representative choice as well. And also actually there is one last point, perhaps it is important. Facebook took some action against the anti-vaccination community in the past 2 years, mostly by removing these kind of groups that you mentioned from search results. So actually they're less accessible to people. So it's more difficult for people to enter in contact with this type of message. On Twitter, it's way easier.
That actually makes sense. I'm surprised that I feel like I'm revealing my biases, but I'm really surprised that Facebook has done something positive about this already.
Yeah, actually they did. It's not something major in my personal opinion, but they tried to tackle this issue in the past, whereas Twitter has only done, I mean, basically very little until this year. And this year they took initiative, like most of our listeners know, by basically blocking a lot of profiles for social reasons mostly. But of course, there are a lot of people in this community that are also interested in vaccines and mostly share anti-vaccination views.
So I'm going to go on a bit of a tangent here and talk maybe just a little bit about Culture Rico, where both of us work. So one of our prime objectives here is to make scientific information accessible to the everyday person, to not have it covered in technical jargon so that it puts off people and that they do not gain the information that they should or that they must have. For example, here, I noticed specifically in your paper, and this is where I'm linking it together, that a lot of parents who decide not to vaccinate the children, they are getting their decisions made by something they read online instead of maybe consulting with their doctors. And they're not really considering the veracity of this information that they're getting. And the content that appeals to them more is more of this, let's say, emotional content than the scientific content. So is this something that really jumped out at you regarding how scientific information is being conveyed?
Yeah, so you touch a really important point here, I think, because of course, I think scientific communication is very important today because like you said, people look for information on Google mostly. So basically this science has been kind of removed for Google science, right? So it is important to give correct information to people, but it is also important to give them instruments to understand the nature of the information that they read online. So as a matter of fact, I'm now working on another project that is a bit of a continuation of the project we are discussing today, which is to find a way to enhance critical thinking skills in the general public for them to navigate through an infodemic. Infodemic is what we are living through right now. So basically, it's circulation of information of any kind, mostly related to scientific misinformation or fake news. And this is very hard indeed for people to understand what's true compared to what's false, because if they do a simple Google search, they will be confused for many scientific topics because they don't have the basis to understand this kind of information. So we need to find a strategy to give people these tools to understand what's a credible source compared to a fake news, for example.
Is this something maybe that also in, let's say, the kind of life skills that schools are building that maybe children aren't being taught anymore? Because I see also that you speak about how much the anti-vaccination groups are linked with conspiracy theories online. Is this something that people are more credible to believing things that they wouldn't have before? Is because it is rising. The anti-vaxxer movement is rising. So people are believing things now that they might not have 10, 15 years ago. Is this all linked? This belief in conspiracy theories such as ruling elites and Pizzagate and whatnot, and the simple disbelief in science?
Yes, actually, it is related. In our research, we find that this is the case. For example, anti-vaccination supporters are also more prone to share contents related to other conspiracy theories, like you say. So there seems to be a clear link between these. And I think that I'm not the only one thinking this, that social media are playing an important role in this process. Basically, every kind of information that we see on Facebook, on Twitter, tends to support our views. So it does not challenge our views most of the times. And this is because there is an algorithm that shows us the information we are mostly interested about. So this is what is called polarization on social media. Basically, by you start from, let's say, a particular interest in something, and then you tend to see only things that are associated with that belief that you have. So you tend to strengthen your positions around a given topic, and also other beliefs that are associated with that tend to come together. So if you, for example, believe that vaccines aren't safe and that they cause autism, then you are also more prone to, say, be a Trump supporter, or to believe that you know, that there is a ruling elite that is hiding something from us, or that 5G networks are causing the COVID-19 pandemic, or that Bill Gates has a huge plan to, you know, to of control of the population, and so on and so forth. So this is what we find with our research. So this is not something that we think, but it's something actually true. And social media probably play the major role in this process.
I'm going to focus on one particular word and name that you have mentioned when you were just talking. So Trump. So Trump supporters and anti-vaxxers, you found a link there.
Yeah, so this was very surprising, actually. We didn't think our research would have such political implications. But, you know, science is like this. So that's what we found. And we reported it. So basically, what we try to do is to understand how the anti-vaccination community is engaged online. So we first of all found that they tend to share emotional contents. You mentioned it before. And that also, basically, they have a very strong community where they share each other's content and so on and so forth. So compared to, let's say, somebody else that is outside this community, they are very engaged. They tend to put likes, share the contents, reply, comment, and so on. And then they use the contents that are generated from a small pool of influencers. And so we try to see, okay, who are the influencers in the anti-vaccination community? And also, who are the influencers in the pro-vaccination community? So basically, we try to understand which individuals or organizations were really important to spread that kind of message, both positive and negative. And maybe it's not surprising to know that the World Health Organization is the only big influencer we found in the pro-vaccination community. But in the anti-vaccination community, we found a lot of different individuals. And the most relevant one was the former president, Donald Trump. So basically, we identified him. He was basically the most relevant influencer in the anti-vaccination community. This doesn't mean that he shared anti-vaccination contents directly. Mm-hmm. So basically, he did in the past, but during his presidency, he didn't share anything saying directly that, for example, vaccines cause autism. But basically, all the anti-vaccination supporters in the Twitter community were sharing Donald Trump's tweets. So there was a clear association between this community and Donald Trump. But not only Donald Trump, we have other profiles, for example, his son or other, you know, even his wife, and several other political figures or public figures associated with this presidency. So it was very clear that his figure and, you know, his entourage was involved in this process, in sharing, in allowing this kind of message to circulate online. And this is something we had to describe because, of course, political individuals and, you know, organizations can have large impact on vaccination choice for the public.
So this is very interesting to me. And while I know you're a scientist, I am going to ask you to speculate just a little bit, because this link between being of a certain political, let's say, mindset and believing in something that can be shown actually to be anti-science. So why of all the medical procedures did vaccinations become the medical procedure that are used for political purposes? Why vaccinations? Why not something like, I don't know, getting a root canal? Why isn't a root canal the way your dentist puts a chip in your mouth? And I hope my saying this doesn't put a new conspiracy theory out there.
Right. So the root canal brings back some bad memories. But your question is very, very important. I think there are two reasons mostly. One is an historical reason, which is the connection of vaccines with autism that has been debunked, of course. But this was related to an old paper published in 1998 in The Lancet by Andrew Wakefield. He was a physician. And basically, he published an article that in theory demonstrated that indeed vaccinations, measles vaccinations, were linked to autism. But this was not true. So the paper was retracted shortly after. Basically, the data were completely manipulated. And he still claims to this day that his data were correct and that there is a link. But of course, he became like the paladin of the anti-vaccination community online. But in fact, the scientific community discredited this work. But in any case, this was too late. Basically, this research was published for a short time and you know, the anti-vaccination community took hold on this publication and made a case out of it. And the second reason, which is more important, I believe, is connected to freedom of choice. So basically, in many countries, there is obligation for people to take vaccines. This has been such an important breakthrough for science. But so at the beginning, people were willing to do that. But still, even at the beginning, you know, there was a community of people that was not okay with the fact that they were obliged to take vaccines, basically, or that their kids had to vaccinate. And this is an important ethical issue. To this day, there are countries that are not, you know, taking these measures. So people are free to choose whether to vaccinate or not. For example, Switzerland. But this is a problem because if the vaccination rate drops below a certain percentage, of course, then we will have diseases that were previously considered as eradicated coming back. So this is a problem. So we need to understand where we can allow people to freely take certain decisions and when this is not the case. And this is a fine line. Ideally, in an ideal world, people would be willing to vaccinate because they understand the importance of vaccines and they would take these decisions by themselves. But this is why it is very important to also do very clear communication about vaccines and about scientific topics in general. But so I think this is the crucial aspect. There will always be people that don't accept when basically there is something compulsory that they have to do to their bodies, whether it's something good or not.
I'm going to go off on another tangent here. I feel like I do that a lot, but there's a personal anecdote regarding vaccines, and of course we don't need to use it, but I wanted to talk about this. You mentioned that in certain countries it's mandatory to get vaccines and in some countries it's not. And as you know, I am from a country that still hasn't managed to eradicate polio, whereas in most of the world, polio has been eradicated and it's just a very simple vaccine. But that's a separate question. So for me, vaccines are very important and I've never questioned the need for getting them. And I'm always first in line to get a vaccine if I can. But I did notice, though, that there is a certain inherently political aspect, and this links back to it, about who gets a vaccine and who doesn't. So when I was, of course, one of the anti-vaxxer movement has a very strong roots in the US. You've already mentioned the connection to the former President Donald Trump. But when I was moving to the US as an immigrant, it was mandatory for me to get certain vaccines, which I'd already had as a child, but they were considered booster shots and I couldn't find the proof that I had already gotten these vaccines. So for me to enter the country, so for me to become an immigrant and to get on the path to citizenship, this was mandatory. I had to get these vaccines. And I found it funny and in some ways, of course, political, that the people who are living in this country, who are already citizens, they do opt out of getting these vaccines. They opt out of getting their children these vaccines. And so I see your point. I absolutely agree with this, that there is a political aspect of choice and something being compulsory on people to get that, I suppose, links to this. Another thing I wanted to mention is that you spoke about the communication, and we've been talking a lot about emotional content. Could you maybe give a little more detail about what emotional content exactly means?
Yes. So emotional content, it's like, you know, the use of, so there are two things. One is the language that is adopted in tweets by the anti-vaccination supporters. And in this case, they use a language that is more associated to what we would use on a daily basis. So it's more connected to emotions, to things that we feel personally about different topics. So when it comes to science or vaccines, these people tend to discuss scientific issues with the same terminology, with the same type of language that you could use in a daily conversation with a friend. So it's a little bit tricky to define exactly what's emotional and what's not emotional. But to make an example, if we, for example, say that, I don't know, today, you know, it's sunny, so it's such a nice day. This could be, you know, something that we say on a daily basis. And if we add that this is making us very happy, you could conclude that this is emotional language, right? But on the other end, you have something more rational and scientific that perhaps is a bit also sterile, that is scientific language. So it could be, you know, out of 150 people today, 32 didn't do something, right? So this kind of comparison language, this kind of language that is based on control, experimental control situation, statistics, on numbers, and so on and so forth. So there is a bit of a contraposition between these two words. And scientists tend to share and use this kind of language with the general public, even though it's not very effective, as we proved. So perhaps a good idea would be to understand what's making emotional language better. So to share information, to make tweets more viral and so on, because this could be used by the pro-vaccination community, for example, by the World Health Organization, to actually promote a certain message that is positive, that is evidence-based, but at the same time, it has the ability to reach out to more people. So this is very important, and it needs to be studied in details. So this is something we may do in the future, to really understand from a linguistic point of view what are the features that make a message, emotional message, more powerful.
Do you think it's also linked a little bit to, let's say, who scientists consider their primary audience? As this is something, I am not in academia, but I've heard this a lot, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, publish or perish. So when somebody is publishing something for an academic audience, the language is absolutely going to be different from what they'd use for, let's say, a tweet or something of let's say something on Facebook, something on Instagram. I use very different language when I'm posting on my social media compared to when I'm writing for Culture Rico. So is this something that the scientific community also needs to focus on, the importance of the everyday audience also along with their peers?
Yes, I mean, here you touched upon something very important. It's something I really care about personally. And I think the root cause of this problem is how science is published. So basically, there are journals so for whoever is in academia, this is kind of something obvious. But if somebody from the non-academic world is listening now, they will need to know that basically there is a private entities that are scientific journals that publish the results of research studies. And they do it for profit. There are different forms. There is open access, there is non-open access, and so on. But it's not very important. What's important is that basically, in order for a scientist to communicate science with other scientists, they need to publish their results in journals. And there is some sort of rules that they have to stick to. And these rules include also linguistic rules. So there is a certain structure for a scientific paper that needs to be respected, with an abstract, with the results section, and so on and so forth. There is a type of language that needs to be used. And this is particularly important because it shapes and defines how scientists should communicate with the rest of the world. And the rest of the world has generally been scientists. So scientists tend to communicate with other scientists at conferences, through scientific papers, in meetings, but they're not used to communicate with the general public. So on the one end, there is some sort of imposition coming from the way science is published about the language that is used in science. And on the other end, there is an inability or a lack of training for scientists to communicate with the general public. So it is particularly important to find strategies to actually teach scientific communication at universities, because this is not done by the great majority of academic institutions right now, and it needs to be changed. But at the same time, the problem of scientific journals and the language associated with it needs to be challenged as well, because these two problems, in my opinion, are very well interconnected.
That is really interesting to know. And as I mentioned, I'm not from academia, so all of this is very very new to me, and I'm very interested to hear about it. I don't want to put all the blame on the scientific writing, though. I do want to talk about social media, and I do want to also talk about, let's say, freedom of speech and how it kind of clashes here. When people are so let's say, passionate and so sensitive about getting vaccines, and how this, if it's something that's mandatory for them, they feel uneasy about it, they politicize it. So how can social media, let's say all these giant conglomerates, how can they control the information that is being shared on their sites without, let's say, veering into curtailing freedom of free speech for people? Right. Well, freedom of free speech is a bit of a bad phrase, but I understand what I mean.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is difficult. It's not, there is not an easy solution for this problem, but there are different ways to, you know, avoid censorship, because, you know, you can imagine that there is a person behind the screen that is selecting whether content is okay and whether another tweet is not okay, for example. And this is a bit arbitrary, right? So there is a lack of definition of what is scientific misinformation, what is a fake news, and so on and so forth. So what is acceptable information? What is an acceptable tweet concerning vaccines and what is not? It's difficult to say. So basically, to avoid being arbitrary in taking this kind of decisions, we need to find an automated system. But I don't mean that there is, you know, an algorithm that tells you, okay, this content is okay and this is not okay, because it would be still censorship in some sort, because you have to define the rules to select content. And that's where still a human being is applying a filter to the information. So we need to find another strategy. And another strategy could be, for example, to use tests for people that use social media, basic scientific critical thinking tests that could be used as a way to understand whether a person has the ability to understand medical contents or scientific contents in general, or for example, associated to vaccines. And then based on that, they will have or not the possibility to share this kind of content. So basically, people will be able to say their opinion freely. So there is no censorship, but at the same time, they may not be able to share a tweet from another person concerning vaccines, or they may not be able to share an article on Twitter concerning vaccines, for example. This is tricky. It needs discussion, right? So it's very difficult to define what's censorship and what's not, but that's one possibility. In the ideal case, anyways, people are informed when they share. So whenever there is contents related to vaccines, they may be presented with this, some links or sort of a banner that, you know, reminds them that this is information connected to, say, COVID-19, and then they can read more by clicking on resources that are provided. So this is another way, for example, and YouTube is doing that. For example, under all videos related to COVID-19, there is an info banner and people can learn more about it. I don't think it's super effective, in my personal opinion, but it is something for sure. What do you think about this kind of strategies?
I have to find it a little funny, because on Instagram, for example, I use it for various purposes. I have multiple accounts and I use some for political purposes, others for fashion purposes. And it is very funny to see that COVID-19 banner to linking to CDC show up on the fashion account every time somebody complains about the pandemic and not being able to wear outfits. So it's a hit and miss, like you said. There's I'm not sure about the efficacy of it either, but I do like knowing. I do have to appreciate the mental peace it gives me, knowing that this banner is going to show up everywhere where there's misinformation being shared as well. And even if by mistake somebody clicks or taps on it, they will be redirected to a site with real information. It's a tricky way to handle it, but like we say, something is better than nothing.
Yes. Yeah, of course. I mean, you said something important, because if these kind of banners are everywhere, then nobody will read them, right? So if it's something that is just vaguely associated with the pandemic, then maybe there is no need for that. So, you know, this kind of, let's say, approaches need to be polished a little bit.
Absolutely. Because anything that might in any way curtail people's right to say whatever they want, no matter how factually incorrect it may be, is something that, especially in the US, I've started to notice people are feeling very, very strongly about. So we do need to come up with strategies that does not, let's say, make people think of elitism or any kind of censorship in any way. But that is a difficult path to tread. But I am also sure that companies that are worth billions and billions of dollars and employ some of the brightest minds in the globe will be able to come up with an effective solution.
Yes, that's true. But at the same time, we should not leave them alone because we...
Absolutely.
Right. We don't have to forget they're driven by profit. So it's tricky. It's tricky. You know, these social media giants are having a lot of power. And actually, recently, they started to behave like states. You know, if you follow the situation with Australia and Google and Facebook.
Yes.
This is a very difficult time because, mm-hmm. you know, when private entities start to act as a state would do, it starts to be problematic. So we have to make sure that regulatory actions are still taken against social media when there is a need for that. So we have to guarantee freedom for these private enterprises to operate. But at the same time, we need to make sure that they don't become the regulators themselves.
I'm a huge fan of regulations, I have to say. This is something that I feel like maybe I mutter in my sleep as well. Regulations, regulations, regulations.
Yeah, I understand. In some aspects, I'm also... You know, that we live in an era where we... On the one end, profit a lot from neoliberalism. On the other end, mm-hmm. we challenge it a little bit because, of course, this also brings some inherent problems. But we haven't found the solution for it, right? This is a debate that is probably going to be long, happening for long in the future.
I'm glad you mentioned Australia, though, because I feel as if the whole world should have their eyes on that and it doesn't get enough news coverage or enough coverage that everybody should know what's happening in that country and
totally agree with you. It's very weird that the coverage is not, there is not such a broad coverage. And I feel that other countries, in the news media also didn't really understand what we are living through right now. This is something, in my personal opinion, it's a historical momentum that we are living through also from that point of view. Everything comes together, of course, because there is an historical event such as the pandemic that is changing our world so fast that, you know, in some aspects we understand it, in some other aspects we don't. And I think media are also playing a part in this process. And they, on the one end, they don't quite understand what we are living through. On the other end, they also, as I said, they play a part, an active part. And maybe it's also a choice to not to give a lot of importance to this, because at the end of the day, also news media are, for the most part, free to determine their own future. And so mm-hmm. they also are having a bit of a skewed opinion, right, on this topic. So I don't quite know. I haven't reflected upon this enough to come up with a strong conclusion, I would say. But I agree with you that we need more coverage of this, more discussion.
You mentioned how quickly the pandemic is changing the way we live. I feel very disappointed when any politician or any big personality mentions, oh, we will get back to the way it was. I don't think I want to get back to the way it was. We have seen extreme lapses in coverage of healthcare. We have seen how women suffered from domestic violence during this situation. We have seen a lot of flaws in our society and our structure and our politics. And honestly, I would want us to utilize this time for the pandemic to make things better. Returning to the status quo is not good enough.
Totally agree.
Yeah. And talking about the pandemic, sorry, I'm interrupting you, but I also want to get back to vaccinations. We are seeing, and this is surprising to me, I don't belong to a generation, at least in my opinion, that has had any problems with generations with vaccinations. I'm sorry. Our parents vaccinated us. They vaccinated everyone, every child they could get their hand on. They jabbed them and we were fine with it. But now with this COVID-19 vaccine, I am seeing my friends hesitate in getting the vaccine. They don't think that Bill Gates is going to put a chip in their head. but they don't want to get vaccinated because they feel very unsure about the development time and the side effects and the long-term health effects. My female friends are worried about how this is going to affect their fertility, for example. So how do you feel about how the efficacy of the COVID-19 vaccine has been portrayed to everybody?
This is important. I think the main reason here for this problem is that there is conspiracy theories on the one end, like we discussed before, but then there is a lot of, you know, scientific misinformation or lack of information, I would say, about different topics. And vaccines, COVID-19 vaccines is one of those. So the problem is that the scientific community and all the scientific communicators, like, for example, the World Health Organization, hasn't been able to come up with a very strong, efficient strategy to present all the issues, discuss with the general public, and explain both the power of vaccines and, on the other end, all the problems, what we actually don't know. So basically, there is a little bit of a problem also in the scientific world when it comes to this. Basically, we don't manage very well to explain what's going on because we are not able to explain also what we don't know. We don't want to admit that there is so much we don't know and that people don't trust this science anymore. So basically, the World Health Organization has been, for example, saying a lot of things at the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of wrong things. They say that the virus was not circulating, so it was not a problem to halt flights. They condemn Trump, for example, locking flights with Europe. They said a lot of things, and that undermined the opinion of the general public and the trust they have in these institutions. And then when there is a vaccination campaign that is so important, such as the COVID-19 vaccine that are coming out, that are of course based on evidence and safety results are published, they are publicly available, we need to trust this process, of course. But at the same time, people don't quite understand how and whether these are actually really safe, considering that the same people that are claiming that these vaccines are safe have also said just a few months ago a lot of things that turned out to be wrong. So we need to be very careful as scientists to give the correct information. But at the same time, when we are not sure, even if we think we are almost sure, we should still say to the people, look, we have a certain likelihood, we think that this works this way, but we are not 100% sure. And this has a lot of applications concerning the pandemic. Think about the origin of the pandemic. We keep discussing about, you know, we should do another podcast on this, but, you know, that the pandemic has originated in a certain way. We all thought in science that it originated in the market in Wuhan. But, you know, this is not the case, most likely. So we need to understand that we still don't know a lot of things and we need to communicate it with the general public. And instead, what the scientific world has done is to cancel all the views, the different views about the origin of the pandemic, classifying them as conspiracy theories, even though they had traits of conspiracy theories, of course, but they were not theories that could be excluded with evidence-based approaches. So basically, there is a difference, in my opinion, between conspiracy theory and a theory. Basically, a conspiracy theory is something that is proved to be wrong. And despite this, all the supporters and believers keep believing in the same, for example, take flat earthers, right? But on the other end, you have also theories that are maybe far-fetched, maybe they are not really, they have a low probability to be true, but they can still be true. So we need to make sure that we find a communicative strategy to explain all these things to the general public. And then ultimately, I think the issue with vaccines will be solved. But of course, you as a person also play an important role, right? So we need to make sure that we explain to our friends and our relatives, our grandparents, that, you know, these are important vaccines. They are safe. I had a discussion, kind of heated discussion with my grandparents during Christmas time. I think I convinced them to get the shot. They didn't receive it yet. They will soon, but this is important. We need to personally take action and do that at home, you know, with friends, with family members.
I felt like that's how I spent all of last summer debunking WhatsApp theories. Eat turmeric and COVID will be cured. Hold your breath for 30 seconds and stand in the first rays of the sunrise and you will never catch COVID again. Oh my goodness, I literally spent all of summer debunking these theories and talking about scientific facts with people. This is definitely something we have to do on an individual level as well.
Yes, but that's challenging.
It's very challenging. It is.
No, I didn't do that. So I decided, you know, I write a paper. I do some research and hopefully, you know, then this will have an effect. But still, I had to, of course, challenge the views of some friends and family members.
Yeah. Good. So I think we have had a really wonderful discussion today about the rise of the anti-vaccine movement, what spurred it, what is leading it right now, and how to maybe counter it on a more structural and an individual level. So, Federico, do you have any last remarks you would like to make to sum everything up?
No, I think we covered pretty much all the topics that are very important here. I just think that all the people listening, if they have any doubt concerning vaccines and in particular concerning vaccines related to COVID-19, there are plenty of resources. And if you need to be helped with finding the right information to read from or to watch on YouTube or anything in this direction, just you know, drop a comment, send us an email, and we will personally take care of, you know, giving you the right information and pointing you in the right direction.
Absolutely. That is something that we would be happy to take care of. Let us know your views about this podcast. Let us know in general how you feel, how you've been dealing with maybe the anti-vaxxer movement in your own personal life and how it's affected friends and life around you. So thank you so much for joining us, everyone. And thank you, Federico, for taking out time from your schedule to discuss your paper with us.
Thank you. It has been a wonderful discussion.
And we will be back with another episode very soon.
Thank you for listening. This episode of Culturico was produced by Omai Nassis and Federico Germani. If you want to read their latest articles on science and culture, you can find their writing at culturico.com. You can also find links to their social media in the show notes. Stay tuned for our next episode, where Jessica Brown interviews Manas Shriak about his latest book, The Town Slowly Empties, on life and culture during lockdown. To get our latest episodes, subscribe to Culturico on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like our content, feel free to give us a review or spread the word. Thank you, and until next time.